Real quick before we start, I just want to plug my Patreon. Patreon is a way for you to get more the Sound and the Story content and to support the show. It's a way for me to keep it ad-free. So go to patreon.com/thesoundandthestory. Sort of the big thing we're doing is the 7-inch single club. We're all do individual songs. So I think I'm going to do like a brand new Tangy Back Sunday with the 270x7, and there's no I in team. And a lot of more recent artists, Craig Finn, Phoebe Bridges, Jeff Rosenstock, that kind of stuff. So I'm really excited about it. I'm really excited about the Singles Club. If you've already signed up, thank you so much. I know that this episode has taken a bit of time. I'm trying to get all my ducks in the row to figure out the technology and everything with the Patreon. But it's up, patreon.com/thesoundandthestory. It means a tremendous amount that you even listen, and so your support would obviously mean that much more. But I think it'll be a really cool way to get some more stuff, because that's what I get the most about this show, is it doesn't come out often enough. So hopefully I'll be able to throw those singles episodes your way if you're a Patreon subscriber. I'm going to do like a newsletter, curated playlist, that kind of stuff. So I'm really excited about it. Throw some dollars my way. Why not, right? And yeah, patreon.com/thesoundandthestory. Is that it? Is that all I had to say? Maybe. Oh, but since you're still listening, patreon.com/thesoundandthestory. Look how that worked out. All right, let's do it. Dashboard Confessional concert recently, and no hipsters, I was not there, ironically. Come on, who doesn't want to scream along the hands down with a room full of strangers? Anyway, one of the opening bands, which I will not name, came on and played a comically rehearsed anodyne set of generic, I hate to call it rock music because that's not fair to rock music. Their stupid assortment of keyboards were washed out by boring, masturbatory guitar solos, and the band reeked of trying too hard. Every jump and kick and whoosh of the hair seemed meticulously rehearsed, which left the audience with the sense that they had just watched a bad play, not just a bad band. I don't even know which is worse. I grew up in the punk scene after the demonization of selling out had fallen away. I mean, Brand New made Devil and God on Interscope, Against Me put out New Wave on Sire, and hell, even Kevin Devine signed to Capitol Records. And none of my friends really cared. All to say, without the stigma of major labels, without having the cultural capital of being indie / DIY, the only real currency left in the scene was your own authenticity. When Devine, and by the way, if you don't know Kevin Devine, please go listen to Brothers Blood right now, signed to Capitol Records, he still played true to who he was, and that's what people cared about. He even has a song about it, called I Don't Care About Your Band, the relevant lyric being, see, I found out your band via blogosphere, via Hidden Hand, your DIY, your test tube made, I wasn't biting, either way, but I care that you're a voice for change who lives the things she sings on stage, a struggler who forgives herself, a human being, and nothing else. Against Me still put out three-chord screeds against capitalism, even as they participated in it. It didn't feel hypocritical, it felt authentic. But when Blink wrote Rock Show because the label said they needed another hit, well, it's not that it's a bad song, it's just not really a song that they wanted to write. And you can kind of tell. Authenticity is the key to art. Sure, anyone can paint a couple colored squares and call it a Rothko, but it's not a Rothko. And one of the main reasons it's not a Rothko, besides, of course, not being a Rothko, is that the artist didn't truly believe in what they were doing. People ask me why I like modern art when, quote-unquote, anyone could do it. And it's because the artist fucking meant it. Whatever he or she did with that canvas or pile of rocks or ready-made urinal, that's exactly what they wanted their art to be. I listen to singers that can't sing, read poetry that isn't metered, and watch movies that are poorly acted. But I love them if they are true to themselves, if they mean it, if they are authentic. 50 told me, go ahead and switch your style up. And if they hate it, let them hate it and watch the money pile up. Right on as always, Kanye. Singer of this band opening for Dashboard told the crowd how much he loved us. I almost threw up my Jack and Coke. The whole time, I half expected him to yell, "Thank you, Cleveland!" Oh, and did I mention they did an ironic Coldplay cover? A Coldplay cover. Let that sink in. The album we're talking about today is decidedly, brazenly authentic. Rilo Kiley wanted to make a record that was different and more adventurous. They ended up doing exactly that, and cementing their place in the indie rock scene. I'm David Callison. This is The Sound and the Story.
Today's the day I realized that I could be loved. It echoed through the park last night. He was in our sun. He belonged to everyone. And this loss isn't good enough for sorrow or inspiration. It's such a loss for the good guys, afraid of this lie that it just is. 'Cause everybody dies.
The following is from the blog One Band, One Week, and I have no idea if it's true. There's no consensus about where the name Rilo Kiley comes from. The band has claimed at different points that the name came from an Australian rules football player, a 19th century Scottish athlete, sports almanacs from both of these countries, and Blink Sennett himself has said that someone named Rilo Kiley appeared in a dream of his and predicted the date of Ginny Lewis's death. I always liked a little mystery anyway. United by their stints as child actors, Ginny Lewis, who graced 80s TV screens in Jell-O, Barbie, and cereal commercials, and Blake Sennett, who starred in season 2 of the short-lived Nickelodeon classic, Salute Your Shorts, and yes, everything I just said is true, formed Rilo Kiley in 1998, along with bassist Pierre DeRieder and drummer Dave Brock, who was later replaced with Jason Bozell. They held a weekly residence at Spaceland in Silver Lake in LA before Silver Lake was even cool, man. Rilo Kiley paraded a blend of country, indie, pop, and torch songs, all anchored by Ginny Lewis's heroic, old-school Whiskey Coke voice. In 2001, they released Takeoff and Landings on Barsook Records, the label owned by Death Cab for Cutie. I did a Death Cab record in episode 4, if you want to go check that out, new listeners. Although Lewis would eventually dominate more and more songs, Sennett contributed his voice on a variety of songs, especially on Takeoff. At this point, Lewis and company met one of my favorite songwriters of all time, Tim Kasher, of The Good Life and Cursive. Kasher was involved with Saddle Creek Records, the heart of the Omaha, Nebraska scene that included Connor Oberst, Bright Eyes, as well as The Faint, and eventually many others. Saddle Creek was the coolest kid on the indie block, and had been previously closed to non-Omaha bands. But Kasher made his first exception and released The Execution of All Things in 2002, produced by Bright Eye, Mike Mogus. You know in the Bright Eye song, Method Acting, when Connor sings, "Michael, please keep the tape rolling"? Well, he's referring to Mike Mogus. Then a couple things happened around the same time, the exact details of which are hazy. What we do know is that a guy named Jimmy Tamborello, a DJ and electronic music artist known as D'Intel, was working with Lewis's old label mate, Ben Gibbard of Death Cab for Cutie, mailing him beats on DAT tapes via the U.S. Postal Service, where their group would eventually cop their name. Lewis either lived in the same apartment complex as Tamborello, caught wind of the project, and would throw down temporary backing vocals on the songs until she eventually became a permanent member. Or, according to another interview, Gibbard cold called her because he remembered her from when they were on the same label. Less romantic, but probably more true. Anyway, Lewis sang on the Postal Service record and joined Tamborello and Gibbard on the road in the spring of 2003. Later that year, Rilo Kiley gathered Tamborello, Mike Mogus, and Mark Trombino, who produced all of Jimmy Eat World's records, to record their next album. They wanted to bust out of their sound and use lots of instrumentation, having very much been influenced by Bright Eyes and the rest of the Saddle Creek sound. In the end, they wanted to make music that was more adventurous. And so they did, and that's part of where the name of the record comes from. It also comes from Frank O'Hara's poem, Meditations in an Emergency. Every time my heart is broken, it makes me feel more adventurous, and how the same names keep recurring on that list. But one of these days, there'll be nothing left with to venture forth. More Adventurous is, without a doubt, a Saddle Creek record. Nate Walcott, the other one-third of Bright Eyes besides Connor and Mike Mogus, contribute heavily to this record as well. He's credited for playing the trumpet, orchestra bells, and flugelhorn, as well as arranging all of the string parts. Mogus played the glockenspiel, the banjo, wurlitzer, guitar, synthesizer, and mandolin. In late 2003, early 2004, Rilo Kiley finished the record and started talking to Saddle Creek about distribution, radio play, etc. And at some point in those talks, the relationship fell apart. Here's Rob Nansel, who ran Saddle Creek at the time. It would have been great to work on the Rilo Kiley record, but there was just some things that we didn't see eye to eye on. Some things that they were interested in were not of interest to us. And rather than making compromises that inevitably would make one party feel uncomfortable or the other party feel shorted, the decision was made for them to do the record without us. Jason Bozell, drummer of Rilo Kiley, said at the time, "We made this record with Saddle Creek and made it for Saddle Creek and figured it would come out on Saddle Creek. Shortly after completing the record, we had some ideas and talked about them with Saddle Creek and discovered that we differed on a couple issues. Ultimately, we created our own record label to have total freedom over the record and the music." That last part is somewhat true. They created an imprint, but it was distributed by Warner Brothers, one of the major labels. They would never sign a band or release another record on that imprint. Here's Bozell again, talking about More Adventurous. "At some point, the hope is that this record would move to Warner Brothers proper," Bozell said. "We wanted that to be a possibility. Even if it had been released by Saddle Creek, that was a possibility. But it wasn't something they were comfortable with. They're definitely crusaders with high morals and ethics, trying to do this thing for the greater good. For some, that's the right approach. For us, it wasn't. We're trying to do something similar, but in a different way. We're trying to enter into that world with full knowledge of the traps. We came in with a finished record and have not compromised it in the least." The main sticking point seems to be the ability to eventually have Warner Brothers handle a wider distribution than Saddle Creek could handle. Remember, this is when CDs were still a thing, so physical distribution was important. Rilo Kiley also wanted to push hard on radio, and that was when radio was still a thing. And the sad fact is that payola was the law of the land. To get on radio, the record company had to pay lots of money to lots of people. Saddle Creek was unwilling to do that. But Rilo Kiley wanted to be successful. They wanted their music to be heard by many and cared less about what hoops they had to jump through to get there. It's a fascinating microcosm of a larger conversation that was happening back in the early 2000s. The music industry was beginning to unravel. Napster came out in 1999, and CD sales, unbeknownst to the industry, would peak in 2000 and then continually fall every year since. Record labels arguably don't matter anymore. But back then, most bands wanted indie rock sound with major label money. More money meant more exposure, meant a bigger audience, meant more press, the whole thing. Remember, the iTunes store didn't come out until April of 2003, and Spotify wouldn't launch until 5 years after that. Remember at the beginning how I was telling you my friends like didn't really care about selling out and authenticity was the true mark of integrity? Well, not everyone thought so, especially the Pitchforkerati, who were very influential at the time. In a way, Rilo Kiley was the last band that sold out, but it was the last band that had something to sell out, too. The entire paradigm was about to change.
Any chimp can play human for a day, uses opposable thumbs to iron his uniform, and run for office on election day. Fancy himself a real decision maker, and deploy more troops than salt shaker. But it's a jungle way war is made, and you'll panic and throw your own shit at the enemy. The camera pulls back to reveal your true identity. Look, it's a sheep in wolf's clothing, a smoking gun holding aim. Any asshole can open up a museum, put all the things he loves on display so everyone can see him. The house, a car, a thoughtful wife. Ordinary moments in his ordinary life. But if she blinks a smile, she'll give you away. 'Cause no one wants to pay to see her happiness. No one wants to pay to see her day to day. And I'm not buying it either, but I'll try selling it anyway.
So the record was released in August of 2004. In 3 short months, George W. Bush would be reelected as president. And all of that, the politics of the time, the politics within the band, the politics between the record labels, all of that were reflected in the first song on the record. It's a Hit.
And articulate all that pain, and maybe you'll get paid.
There's a lot going on in this song. Both political and social commentary, as well as commentary on the band's potential commercial success. The first lines, "Any chimp can play human for a day, uses opposable thumbs to iron his uniform, and run for office on election day, fancy himself a real decision maker, and deploy more troops than a salt shaker, then a salt in a shaker, then salt in a shaker." There we go. Is a direct... a direct homage to the fact that W wasn't considered the brightest bulb in the lamp, and he also kind of looked like a monkey. And then, of course, this album was written right after the start of the Iraq War, in which W deployed 130,000 American troops. The next bit, "Any asshole can open up a museum, put all the things he loves on display so everyone could see them, the house, a car, a thoughtful wife. Ordinary moments in his ordinary life. But if she breaks a smile, she'll give you away, because no one wants to pay to see her happiness. No one wants to pay to see her day to day. And I'm not buying it either, but I'll try selling it anyway." This is about culture, being enraptured with everything men do. And you can look at his car and his wife, every little moment in his life. But culture isn't interested in the woman's life. And then Lewis says that she's just as guilty as not being interested. "I'm not buying it either," she says. But she acknowledges through her music that she wants to do exactly that. She wants people to pay to see her day to day. Any idiot can play Greek for a day and join a sorority or write a tragedy. And articulating all that pain, and maybe you'll get paid. But it's a sin when success complains, and your writer's block, it don't mean shit. Just throw it against the wall and see what sticks. Gotta write a hit. I think this is it. It's a hit. She's commenting directly on this need to use her pain in her art, which gets her paid. But when you're successful and you complain about something, like having writer's block, it doesn't matter. You're forced to just churn out another hit to keep producing good art. And she then sarcastically says, "I think this is it. It's a hit." A double meaning of a hit song and taking a hit. And then she finally takes a shot at the death penalty, singing, "Any fool can play executioner for a day and say with fingers pointed in both directions, he went that away. It's only a switch or a syringe, exempt from eternal sins, but you still wear a cross and you think you're going to get in." So she sees the death penalty as immoral, essentially as murder, and those who sentence someone to it or carries it out despite their claim to be religious is not getting into heaven. But the pardons never come from upstairs. They're always a moment too late. But it's entertainment. Keep the crowd on their toes. It's justice. We're safe. It's not a hit. It's a holiday. Shoobop, shoobop, my baby. This is the idea that executions used to be these big public spectacles. Tens of thousands of people would come to see top royalty or political figures beheaded in Revolutionary Square in Paris in the late 1700s. So these wars, these public show of force, all amount to bread and circus, an attempt to distract and placate the populace. The ending, "Shoobop, Shoobop, My Baby," is a dark and sarcastic nod to the entertainment aspect, the cable news aspect of war, as if the whole thing is a show and real people aren't really dying. The chorus, "It's a holiday for a hanging," gets at this idea as well. But it relates to every verse here because he's eventually saying people will come out and watch pain and failure. They want shit to be fucked. They want you to suffer for your art. They want their team to win. It all becomes a spectacle, a holiday for a hanging, a public execution.
Get a real job. Keep the wind at your back and the sun on your face. All the immediate unknowns are better than knowing this tired and lonely fate. Does he love you? Does he love you? Will he hold your tiny face in his hands? I guess it's spring, I didn't know. It's always 75, no melting snow. A married man.
Lewis, as you can tell, is a spectacular storyteller. And much of her stories have little twists, little aha-type moments. It's also worth noting that Lewis started this band with Sennett while they were dating, and they continued to date until the band broke up. Or the band continued until they broke up. Either way. But there's a lot of talk of marriage, commitment, and maternity on this record, which I think is because Lewis was a couple years off 30 and thinking hard about her current relationship and where it might lead. In the first verse of "Does He Love You," Lewis gives advice to her friend, who's obviously feeling a bit down. "Get a real job, keep the wind at your face." And then Lewis asks her friend if her man really loves her. Basically, if she should be with him. Then Lewis switches perspectives, as she does many times on this record, over to her own. And when I say her own, I mean her character, the person in the song that she refers to as I, which is definitely different than the actual Ginny Lewis. Anyway, she tells of her life in California. She didn't even know it was spring because the weather never changes, which is a humble brag, right? Like, "Oh, I didn't even realize it was winter. It's so nice here all the time." And she tells her friend about a married man who says he wants to leave his wife and move out to California to be with Lewis. She switches again to talking about her friend and says, well, I guess it worked out. You got married and you had a kid, and I guess he did love you. And even though you say you didn't want to settle down, quote, used to say you were flawed if you weren't free, well, I guess you were wrong. There's a little spike going on here, and I think if you're old enough, you've had this experience, well, where you'll commiserate and celebrate your singledom with someone and say shit like, no one will ever tie me down again, no one will ever change me, and then watch them immediately jump back into a long-term relationship. So there's definitely some of that bitterness in that line. Then Lewis sings, let's not forget ourselves, good friend. You and I were almost dead, and you're better off for leaving. Yeah, you're better off for leaving. She's sort of talking to herself here, countering her own point that her friend used to say that they were flawed if they weren't free, with the idea that when the two friends were together, they were hard partying, they were kind of going nowhere. She admits that her friend was better off moving away. Then it's back to the friend, who confesses. She says that she didn't love him, to answer Lewis's original question, but she felt her time to have kids and have a family, was running out, and so she just went for it. But then when they had the kid, everything made sense, and she really did love him, and it would be so great if she hadn't overheard him saying that he wants to leave her for some girl in California. And that's the reveal. Lewis is the girl her friend's husband has been writing to and wants to come out to California to visit. She sings, let's not forget ourselves, good friend. I am flawed if I'm not free, and your husband will never leave you. He will never leave you for me. It's a brilliant song because Lewis leans hard into the bitterness. She's pissed that her friend didn't even love him at first, and she still gets to have a happy little life with this man that she now wants. And at the same time, the friend would be devastated to learn that Lewis is a girl that her husband wants to go after. That's her best friend. So, the webs we weave, right? This album is so rich we don't have time to address it, but I want to pull out this theme of more adventurous and the sense of Lewis going against people's expectations of her and her band. In the title track, she sings, I've been trying to nod my head, but it's like I've got a broken neck, wanting to say I will as my last testament. For me to be saved and you to be brave, we don't have to walk down that aisle, because if marriage ain't enough, well, at least we'll be loved. She just wants to go along with the crowd to say yes to things, but she can't. She comes to the conclusion, or really it sounds like she's trying to convince herself, that they don't have to get married. But clearly people expect them to. And again, commenting on the status of relationships, he sings, in absence of God, and I say there's trouble when everything is fine, the need to destroy things creep on me every time, and just as love's silhouette appears, I close my eyes and disappear tonight. And something's got to change, because our love's the slowest moving train. She's saying that she's at her worst when things are stable, and just when people or society or a partner want to move forward or take the next step, she just wants to destroy things. My therapist calls this the need for constant state change. There are those among us that, when things are calm, we need a state change. We need drugs or liquor, or to end an old relationship, or to start a new one, or to quit a job. Something to cause state change. Lewis discusses the same idea in Portions for Foxes. That title, by the way, comes from a Bible verse, Psalm 63, verse 10. They shall fall by the sword, they shall be portioned for foxes. As in, we will all just die and become food. In that song, Lewis sings about someone she knows is bad news, bad news, bad news. And she knows that getting into a long-term relationship, even having sex with them, leaves no mystery left. And her friends tell her to leave him, but she doesn't care, she likes him. Another example of doing something bad for you. Just to be more adventurous. Just to subvert the expectation of her friends. To just find that state change. I'm just bad news, bad. A Man, Me, Then Jim is a triptych with three narrators. The first verse is about a man whose friend kills himself, and at the funeral he sees an ex-lover and asks what he did to drive her off. Then Lewis is the narrator in the second verse and takes a phone call from a lady selling magazines and asks the lady how she is. The lady goes into a story of how her husband is leaving her and taking their kid, and the lady doesn't know what she did to drive him off. And then Jim is the narrator in the third verse, and he's driving in LA and he sees his lover's old house, and he ardently professes his love for this girl, Diana. And Diana, in my favorite line on the record, goes, "You can promise me indifference, Jim, but my mind is made up, and I'll never let you in again." What this song shows is that Lewis is in on the joke here. She knows that each of these characters knows what drove the other away. Lewis is an omniscient narrator over the entire album, asking questions she knows the answers to, discussing dilemmas she knows the solutions to. She knows that the bullying portions for Fox isn't good for her, and it will end in disaster. As she sings herself, "There's no accidental death when you're the Indian in the cougar's nest." Cougars were well-known predators in pre-colonial America, so basically if you're a Native American hanging out in a cougar den, well, you can't be too surprised with the result. And Lewis isn't surprised here at all. She commands these characters, orchestrates them, sets them up, watches them fall. And while the music is indeed more adventurous, what's truly and most of all part of this record is Lewis herself. Bold and brash in her songwriting, storytelling, sexuality, and voice. I mean, listen to her sing on "I Never" and try to convince me that she's afraid of anything.
But I had never, 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 never met you. So baby, be good to me. I got nothing to give you, you see, except everything.
Honestly, this record reminds me a lot of Kanye's My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, which was similarly clear, confident, and expanded Kanye's sound. More Adventurous was the critical peak of Rilo Kiley's career. Their next record, a dark, dancey record, was groovy and catchy, but didn't quite capture the critics or fans in the same way. The band officially broke up in 2011, but didn't release a proper studio album after Under the Blacklight in 2007. Lewis would go on to have a very successful solo career. You can go listen to her song Rabbit Fur Coat if you don't believe me. Judging from my own ex-girlfriends, this record struck a powerful chord with women, a shining light in a sea of white boys in skinny jeans. But the legacy of this record is much greater, one that, like Pavement, Sleater-Kinney, and Built to Spill before them, would give bands permission to try different sounds, to fuck around, to tell different types of stories, to chase their own state change, to cash in on their own authenticity. that's what I got for you. That's Rilo Kiley. As always, I say, I hope I did enough. I hope I did enough for you. Again, hit up that Patreon, patreon.com/thesoundandthestory, so that you can get more content. So even if I didn't do enough, you can have more, and it'll be glorious. And those are going to start happening literally the week after I post this episode. So I'm super excited about that. And next month, it's a good one, kids. We're doing Counting Crows, August, and everything after. I know. I'm convinced that this is one of the pinnacle albums of the 90s that often gets overlooked just because Mr. Jones is a catchy song. I think Mr. Jones is a brilliant song, and I'll talk about why. I'm really excited for this one. And then after that, can I talk about after that? I think I can tell you that I'm doing Julian Baker after that. So that should be really fun too. So those are all coming up. Counting Crows next month, Julian Baker after that. I'm, as always, I try to get this out as fast as I can. I know that I always fail, but it takes a while. So, you know, I have like a job and stuff. Yeah, that's it. This song is Pictures of Success. It's one of my favorite Rilo Kiley songs. No, you know what? This is Rabbit Fur Coat. We're going to play Rabbit Fur Coat. This is a Ginny Lewis solo track. My mom loves this song. I love it too. So I'm going to play that for you as we go out. Patreon.com/thesoundandthestory. I'm on Twitter at David Callison, KALLISON. You can email me, dcallison@mac.com. What else? How other ways? I'm on Instagram at David Callison or something, probably. Yeah. I love you all. Thank you so much. That's all I have for you.
Peace.
She put a knife to her throat, and over that rabbit fur coat, when my ma refused, the girl kicked dirt on her blouse. Stay away from my mansion house. My mother really suffered for that, spent her life in a gold-plated body cast. Now you ask, did she get that girl back? She paid a visit to that mansion house. She knew the girl was not there, but her father was in cufflinks with slicked back black hair. She took off that rabbit fur coat. And who do you think came home? Miss So-and-so. She took one look at my ma and what did she say? Why are you stealing from our mansion? Mr. So-and-so, he invited me in, I'm a girl no more. Then she dragged my ma out by her throat and over that rabbit fur coat. Let's move ahead 20 years, shall we? She was waitressing on welfare. Says to my ma, you treat your girl as your spouse. You can live in a mansion house. And so he did. And I became $100,000 kid when I was old enough to realize to wipe the dust from my mother's eyes. Is all this for that rabbit fur coat? But I'm not bitter about it. I packed up my things and let them have at it. she's putting that stuff up her nose and still wearing that rabbit fur coat. But mostly I'm a hypocrite. I sing songs about the deficit, but when I sell out and leave Omaha, what will a mansion house in a rabbit.